Today's show is sponsored by Audible. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin for your free audiobook download.
The Angry Young Wolf, Mussolini on the Veranda, a big windbag who just likes to hear himself talk. All terms used to describe Dan Carlin earlier in his career. Now that he's mellowed with age, he's more like a fine cigar or a steak smothered in bacon. He'll still kill you with common sense. It'll just take longer.
The president gave the annual State of the Union address a little while ago, and a couple weeks ago, and I didn't live tweet during the thing, which sometimes I'll do if we've got like an election going on or something. Maybe I'll be in front of the TV, and what the heck, I'll just start interacting with all of you out there. And by the way, you can go to at DC Common Sense if you'd like to do that. Not promising anything scintillating. Some people do that on their little description of themselves. Won't waste your time with this tweet. I don't know that I won't do that, so sign up at your own risk. Nonetheless, I didn't do anything during the State of the Union. And some of the people were like, well, why didn't you do anything during the State of the Union? And I thought, well, you know, I mean, who's taking that seriously? I mean, once you've, this is a difference in age, too, because when I was 22, I'd have been glued to the thing. But when you've seen enough of them after a while, you can see what it is, right? I mean, these are setups for campaigns. And when I started to say this in response to some of the people that had sent me some tweets, they, in a very nice way, all these people are very nice. They said, you're starting to sound a little cynical, Dan. And I thought to myself, wait a minute. I mean, this is just politics. What do they mean cynical? And I guess I understand what they mean, but at the same time, to me, it's so self-evident that this is politics that I no longer find it easy to see it the way I used to. Maybe that's a good way to put it. When I was 22, if I'm talking to my 22-year-old self, there'd be a hard time finding common ground because, I do. I sound like a cynical, I was going to say old man, but shall we say on the way to, the other side of middle age. How can we play this, Ben, in a way that sounds good? I was looking at some video of myself. Maybe I'll post something to that said Twitter feed at some point with like a screenshot or something. And you just laugh at yourself when you're younger. Sometimes if I'm really sounding like I was having a good day, I might say, oh, cute kid, right? On the days I'm not having a good day, I just wince when I see things like of myself years ago. But it is what it is, and we're all like that, right? And if we're not, we're probably still wearing the same clothes and everything that we used to have. I always think if I didn't get married, I'd still be like in the same clothes. If I didn't have a wife to look out for me, I would look ridiculous. Nonetheless, I thought in some of these videos I looked a little ridiculous, but it was funny watching the 22-year-old version of me in video arguing politics with some 50-year-old man, which is just about where I am now. I mean, I have it on video. I mean, the guy was not a very competitive arguer, but nonetheless, I wince at some of the things I said. But part of it is because I'm not yet cynical, and cynical is sometimes based on what you've lived through. When we watch politicians, it's easy to lose faith and not believe what they say and assume everything that they say is done for some sort of political reason. So this is my bias going into it based on experience, but that doesn't mean Jack. It wouldn't have meant Jack to my 22-year-old self either. Nonetheless, my cynical, infected by politics, looking at this through the lens of Washington, D.C. self, sees things like the State of the Union as nothing more than the positioning for the next election, right? In this case, it's the president positioning his party for the 2016 presidential elections and setting things up. And we told you at the, end of last year in November that, the November elections that were the midterms that just happened, those are the kickoff point for the 2016 presidential election. The State of the Union speech is where one side kind of tries to choose the battlefield that the major issues will be fought upon. If you look at the president's speech, he's clearly choosing, a fantastic battlefield for the Democrats. If the 2016 presidential contest is a war, the Democrats are the Native Americans who have chosen the dangerous, rocky, mountainous terrain in which to fight. Their homeland, kind of, if you want to phrase it that way. The Democrats are going to fight over, middle class issues. Going to take the center of America and champion their cause, and occasionally mention poor people too. Since there are a lot more middle class and poor people, that's always a good political move. Second of all, it ties right into Democratic Party branding. Hate to even sound that way, but that's how they talk, folks. This is marketing. What is the Democratic Party brand? The Democratic Party brand is the party of the little guy and the people and all that, right? It's a less left-leaning version of Britain's Labour Party, in a way. Depends on what era you choose. But most political systems have a sort of a lefter party and a sort of a righter party. Where they are on the spectrum could be crazy. I mean, pre-Nazi Germany, the Weimar Republic had that too, but, you know, their left and right got all the way to communist on one side and Nazis on the other. The United States one is, you know, slightly left of center and slightly right of center in a country where the center is more to the right than just about every other major nation on the planet. So understand where we fit on the global political spectrum. The United States is a center-right country by world standards. Now, the Democratic brand is not something that cynical 49-year-old Dan Carlin buys into anymore. This is going to, once again, estrange me from my 22-year-old self. I just watched a video, and like I said, winced many times, but I had much more hair. I mean, you know, there's a trade-off. Don't like what I say as much, but like the way I look a lot better. And I was defending the Democratic Party. That's what I was doing in the place where I was at 22 years old on camera, right? On a crazy, like, early shock jock show is the only way to describe it. And I wasn't shock jockey, but the guy I was debating was. But nonetheless, if I'd have told my 22-year-old self then that I would wince a little bit at my defense of the Democratic Party in 1985 or 86 or whenever it was, once again, I would have thought I was a cynical old man. I might have nodded respectfully, but I mean, I would have thought to myself, well, this must be what happens when you get old. You know, your hope dries up and you become a cynic. But, you know, part of what changes the 22-year-old version into the 49-year-old version of me is the intervening years and what you witness, you know, during that time. And politics, for most true believers of either party, is a case of watching over and over and over again Lucy from the Peanuts comic strip holding that football for Charlie Brown to kick and pulling it away every time, and the next time having to just come up with a better excuse to get you to believe that this time they will actually kick the football in whichever direction you want, conservatively, liberally, whatever. And when you watch the differences between the promises and the achievements or the attempts at achievements, you begin to be able to kind of measure in a Las Vegas line way, you know, the way you would set up a betting line in Vegas. You could begin to handicap the politics versus, you know, the real promises and the principles. Maybe that's how we should say it. You can begin to handicap the politics versus the principles. Now, is the handicapping always right? No, it's not always right when you're doing it with football or basketball either. Right? The house doesn't always win, but most of the time you're going to come out ahead. And if you assume that what these people say in a State of the Union address or a response to the State of the Union address or what have you, miscellaneous visits for no apparent reason to Iowa, and I'm not running for president, right? Again, who buys all this stuff? But to the people who are making those statements, they put about as much stock into that one as they do about promising you whatever they have to promise you to get elected. The president isn't running for re-election. That's obvious, right? His worry at this point is legacy. Protect what you've done and achieved that will end up in the history books. And if you're lucky, get a little something extra before you're done, right? Sometimes you can get a Hail Mary in there before you leave office and boom, something good happens, gets added right to the historical resume. But the president's not out to win campaigns, but his party is. And the president is a fantastic, you know, weapon when the public sees him positively to help the party do that. In the State of the Union address, the 2015 version that just happened a week or two ago, President Obama laid out the battlefield, and the battlefield is in large part going to be this terrain that's known to the media by the phrase income inequality. The question then comes up, why now? Well, besides the fact that this is the Democratic brand, there are other considerations. In other words, just because this is the Democratic brand, if it's not a good time to trot out that particular branding element, they won't. In 1994, when Bill Clinton is running for president as a new Democrat, in air quotes, he's distancing himself from the party that existed in the 1980s and the 1970s, a much more liberal Democratic Party, because they didn't win presidential elections. The branding sounded stale, and it was out of touch with a lot of the public mood in the 1980s, for example. So the rebranding occurred. The rebranding was the New Democrats. The New Democrats seized a lot of the policies of the old Republicans because they ended up having a lot of the same contributors. The branding could still be trotted out. They could still be the party of the people because in comparison to the traditional Republican branding, they didn't have any competition. But if people at the time weren't caring that much about blue-collar politics, as it used to be called, the Democrats wouldn't emphasize blue-collar politics. They're not idiots, right? But now's a good time to emphasize blue-collar politics. A Gallup poll from the start of this year, early January 2015, listed as the number two concern in the country, the economy in general, according to Americans. The number three concern was jobs. The number four was health care. Those are all things that can be rolled into the income inequality, you know, burrito, if you will. But the number one concern was government, Congress, and politicians. In other words, you have this wonderful moment where the main concern are the people who are supposed to do something about the priorities of Americans. And the number two, three, and four priorities of Americans in the January Gallup poll are all these issues that could, you know, fall under the blue-collar politics umbrella, right? Perfect time to trot out the traditional branding. And that's what the president did in the State of the Union address. So he had lines in the speech, which I printed out, one that said, "Will we accept an economy where only a few of us do spectacularly well, or will we commit ourselves to an economy that generates rising incomes and chances for everyone who make the effort?" It's a good line, isn't it, to appeal to the, you know, people in this country who, you know, are hurting or who see a future that looks much more constrained than what they had planned. The president says, quote, "We believed we could reverse the tide of outsourcing and draw new jobs into our shores. And over the past 5 years, our businesses have created more than 11 million new jobs." That sounds pretty good, too, on paper, doesn't it? He said, quote, "We believed we could prepare our kids for a more competitive world. And today, our younger students have earned the highest math and reading scores on record. Our high school graduation rate is at all-time highs. More Americans finish college than ever before." These are all great lines. But to me, this is a wonderful example of how we are skirting the big issue. And I'd like to, of course, get into the big issue today if we can. And I think the reason we're skirting it is because it's one of those issues that, first of all, is a bipartisan creation over the years. So, I mean, you know, you can't really slam one side or the other for it. But because it reveals very uncomfortable potential truths that are much, much more difficult for the politicians of this country to try to wrestle with. I'd like to do a show today, if we can, on the future of work. A little bit of a conversation on jobs and income inequality. Now, we've been talking about this subject since the podcast began. I mean, one of the earliest shows we ever did was called Jobs for Average Joes. We did another one called What About the Losers? And it's those are focusing on my problem with the so-called inequality situation. I hate that term, by the way. I hate it because to me it frames the issue in a way that changes what's important and gives ammunition to people who will simply scream, you know, class warfare if you talk about trying to help people who need, you know, more in this country in terms of, you know, what our society can do to create more people who are doing better, right? And income inequality sounds like something designed to, you know, describe class envy. I think I can speak for a lot of Americans. That's a very arrogant thing to say, isn't it, Ben? I can speak for Ben, too, if there is a Ben. Maybe I can't speak for you, Ben. When I say that I have no problem at all with people making tons of money. I mean, when I was researching the show, you know, there are all these different articles by rich people and people who support the rich talking about all the great things that rich people do and what an important role they play in developing things and investing in things. And I agree with all of that stuff. Not only do I think rich people are fine, I think super rich people are fine. I think if people have a chance in this country to be rich, it's a wonderful incentive. It's great for Americans to dream. You could hit the lottery or you could invent Facebook. You never know what you might do. The potential the incentive that that holds out, and then all the good you can do. You know, you might not care about money, but think of the things you could do with it for the things that are important to you. I mean, I think that's great. And I think, you know, in that sense, the United States is the greatest opportunity, you know, incubator of all time. But to pretend that that's a system that just can take care of itself is where I deviate from some others who also agree with that. The problem in my mind with the income inequality question are the people that aren't doing well enough. And that's always been the poor people. But in the last, you know, economists and people who talk about this will disagree when this started. But let's just safely say the last 30 years. That's safe. You know, over the last 30 years, a shrinking and endangered middle class in this country. There are whole theories devoted to why what is an extremely large chunk of the American economic demographic, why they don't get more attention for their situation. And a lot of it has to do, as you might imagine, with, you know, contributions to government and whatnot. The middle class has no lobbying group that just defends the overall issue of the middle class. And needless to say, the poor don't either. In a nation where more and more attention is generated on the part of politicians dealing with your problem when there's a lot of money devoted to that issue, it's no surprise that issues like how's the middle class doing and what's being done to create less poor people, that those things are not high on the agenda, right? Again, you know, 22-year-old Dan Carlin might say, that's why we have a party who focuses on the little guy. 49-year-old Dan Carlin says, I don't see a lot of movement on the little guy, although let's say there are some, and I want to give credit where it's due, so a little bit more on that later, too. And again, I think that that keeps one party able to still say, well, if you want to vote for the little guy, we did that. And as Democrats have said to me over and over and over again, that right there, Dan, is reason enough for me to have voted for Democratic Party X candidate. Now, that's Dan Carlin's view, right? I'm worried about the wages of the middle class and the lower class. Rich people don't bother me at all. But there are economists out there, and one of them recently wrote a book that got a ton of play. I mean, it was almost exciting to see that a book could get that much play. It was a French economist, a young guy named, I hope I get his last name correct, Thomas Piketty. This is what happens when you're a reader, folks. You don't hear people pronounce names correctly, so you have to, I wish they would put pronunciations after them. Thomas Piketty, and he wrote a book where he basically really shined the spotlight on this so-called income inequality question. And he had phrases in it that were you know, like smacks to the face in terms of trying to make the reader aware of the gravity of this subject as this economist saw it. And he said, for example, that in terms of income that's generated by work, in other words, paychecks, for example, that the level of inequality in the United States is, he said, quote, probably higher than in any other society at any time in the past, anywhere in the world, end quote. That is a slap across the face statement. I mean, Americans just don't see their economy like that. I mean, we may understand that there's a big difference between that movie star who pulls up in the limousine and comes out on the red carpet and someone in the, you know, hills of West Virginia, you know, who doesn't have hot running water. We understand that there's a big difference, but even, you know, I mean, we can all think back to Roman empires and other eras in history where it's crazy the difference between high and low. If that statement is correct, that's a slap across the face. Now, as you might imagine, statements like that brought out all the people that go rah-rah, exactly right. I mean, the U.S. economist Paul Krugman has talked in a not quite so slap across the face way about the same issues from a very similar viewpoint. It also brought out the people that point out how numbers can be fudged to make things look a different way. I have a piece in here from former Texas Senator Phil Graham, a Republican, who goes into all of the variables and extra things that were left out by the French economist and also by people like Krugman when they make these pronunciations. So, for example, had many paragraphs like this. First, he talks about the dark, you know, country that Thomas Piketty mentioned, and then he says, quote, If that dark picture doesn't sound like the country you lived in, that's because it isn't. The Piketty-Sayers study looked only at pre-tax cash market income. It did not take into account taxes. It left out non-cash compensation, such as employer-provided health insurance and pension contributions. It left out Social Security payments, Medicare and Medicaid payments, and more than 100 other means-tested government programs. Realized capital gains were included, but not the first $500,000 from the sale of one's home, which is tax-exempt. IRAs and 401ks were counted only when the money is taken out in retirement. Finally, he writes, the Piketty-Sayers data are based on individual tax returns, which ignore, for any given household, the presence of multiple earners. End quote. He then goes on, he says, you know, we have to take this, we have to assume he would have been caught by someone if he wrote something as he did in the Wall Street Journal about this. It was called How to Distort Income Inequality, by the way, by Phil Graham and Michael Solon, appeared in the Wall Street Journal's online edition November 11th, 2014. He says, as to the numbers after recalculating and including all those things he said were left out, quote, the result is dramatic. The bottom quintile of Americans experienced a 31% increase in income from 1979 to 2007, instead of the 33% decline that is found using the Piketty-Sayers market income measure. The income of the second quintile, often referred to as the working class, rose by 32%, not the 0.7%. The income of the middle quintile, America's middle class, increased by 37%, not 2.2%. Graham and Solon write, quote, by omitting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, the Piketty-Sayers study renders most older Americans poor when most have above-average incomes. The exclusion of benefits like employer-provided health insurance, retirement benefits, except when actually paid out in retirement, and capital gains on homes misses much of the income and wealth of the middle and upper middle-income families. End quote. So in other words, what they're basically saying is when you add in the various things that have been done by government to help out the poor and middle class, those numbers change. If you only look at their paychecks, you get a distorted view. Now, and I think there's some truth to that. But I would argue that these things that the government throws in are often instead of dealing with more bedrock issues. And so this problem continues, and we don't ask really important fundamental questions. Things about the future of work, for example. You see, when a lot of Americans hear Phil Graham and his co-author write something like that, what they're going to hear is someone denying what they think they see. In a sense, sometimes these kinds of games over whether or not Americans are really hurting and you try to show by statistics that they are or are not, is a game that doesn't matter because you're not going to convince people who think they are hurting that they aren't hurting because you prove it with statistics, right? All you might convince them of is that they're the only ones hurting, and that's going to make them feel even worse. You know, a lot of, there's an argument you'll hear that you come across sometimes with folks who are denigrating the level of America's poverty. Let's put it that way. They will say things like, the poor in America are the richest poor people in world history, right? And they'll point out that you want poor? Go look at what the kids in Mexico, you know, with no shoes are like. That's poor. These poor people in the United States have, you know, disability insurance. They have iPhones. They have cable TV. And they'll go down the list of the various things they have. But, you know, survey after survey has shown that to the people who are hurting, all that matters is they have to think they're hurting, right? They're the ones who get to decide whether they feel aggrieved by their financial condition, and you telling them that, you're not as poor as you think, you know, buck up, isn't going to work. They measure themselves by whatever the societal, you know, middle ground is seen as. Whatever someone thinks a middle-class lifestyle is how a person is going to determine where on the American economic spectrum they belong. There are some, and admittedly, they happen to be at the very highest end of the economic spectrum, who suggest that America's expectations of what they should have based on their, you know, income is wrong, and that that's the problem, and that that's what needs to be addressed. This is an article from Bloomberg News, which is obviously a kind of a financial conservative outlet. And Bloomberg writes this story, but this story appeared everywhere. But let me quote from the beginning of the piece. The headline is "Billionaire Green Bets on U.S. While Bemoaning Jobs," by Matthew G. Miller from the January 23, 2015 edition. From the beginning of the piece, quote, "Billionaire Jeff Green, who amassed a multi-billion dollar fortune investing in real estate and betting against subprime mortgage securities, says the U.S. faces a jobs crisis that will cause social unrest and radical politics. Quote, America's lifestyle expectations are far too high and need to be adjusted so we have less things and a smaller, better existence," Green said in an interview today at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. "We need to reinvent our whole system of life." He says, quote, "I'm remarkably long for my level of pessimism," he said. "Our economy is in deep trouble. We need to be honest with ourselves. We've had a realistic level of job destruction and these jobs aren't coming back." He says, quote, "My greatest worry for our country is that globalization and the exponential growth of technology, which have destroyed millions of jobs already, will undoubtedly eliminate millions and millions more jobs during the next several years," he said. "Many manufacturing jobs that we lost will come back to the U.S., but most will likely be filled with robots and software," end quote. Now, as you might imagine, the tone of a lot of these articles, but not in Bloomberg, thank goodness, was, can you imagine the chutzpah of this uber-rich guy who flew his own private jet and 12 people with him to the big economic forum in Davos, Switzerland, the chutzpah of the guy to go out there and say, your expectations need to be lowered because you can't afford it. I'll tell you what, though, in some ways I appreciate the honesty. For years when we've been talking about this issue, we focused on trade deals as one of the things to be concerned about. And it's considered to be, you know, if you go look at the listed potential reasons for the income inequality, for lack of a better phrase, situation in the country, one of the things that's on there as a potential contributor is the trade deal question. But I use it to point out that the reason it matters is because where we are today isn't an accident. It is a bipartisan destination that the two parties and politics in Washington has been moving us towards, you know, at the behest of millions and millions and millions of dollars donated to campaigns to get us here. And again, this is why, you know, the Democratic branding sometimes looks very hollow to me, because when we sit there and talk about how things are not right for a whole lot of Americans and we need to do more for them, you think to yourself, well, it might have been better off if you hadn't disregarded what, you know, all these Americans could have used 20 years ago. Nonetheless, you know, spilt milk and water under the bridge and all that. But what that billionaire is saying is something that a lot of people in his class are very receptive to. And it's that you're not really poor. It's that you spend on stuff that a person of your income shouldn't have. And by the way, there's some merit to this argument. I mean, there's, you know, there's a lot of ways to look at the subprime housing situation, the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and all that. And one angle of it is that a lot of people were buying homes that they couldn't afford, really, based on their income. And in a funny way, this gets back to government doing kind of what government is talking about doing to address this income inequality problem now, which is saying things like, well, we'll help. We'll help Americans. You know, more Americans own their own home. It's a wonderful sentiment, but what if they can't afford that home, right? And what if we do this on a wide scale and lots of them can't afford their home? Did we really help middle-class Americans? Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't help middle-class Americans, but if we start looking at the core issue here, we might be able to help middle-class Americans in a way that doesn't screw them over, you know, in the end, because really we gave them an unsustainable lifestyle. Let's work on giving them, you know, the kind of income to have the kind of lifestyle where they can afford that house and they don't get into trouble down the road. The key to all these questions, ladies and gentlemen, is jobs. And it's not just jobs. The key is what you never hear the politicians talk about. It's good jobs. Which gets you to the overall question, where are these good jobs going to come from? And what on earth does a person have to make so that, you know, they can have what is seen as a middle-class lifestyle today and not be in the position that billionaire says that they can't afford their expectations? What if we try to increase their income so that it can match their expectations? When were these expectations developed? Maybe it's worth talking about this for a minute, because That's actually brought up in some of these studies. Economists often refer to the period right at the end of the Second World War to about 1972, 73, 74 as the golden age when it comes to Americans and their economic expectations. This is the period where we all developed this idea of the 1950s, two-family home with the suburban lifestyle. I mean, the whole idea of what a middle-class American dream was like was established during this golden age. Now, why was it a golden age? Well, the Second World War had just ended. There was only one power in the world that was not only one major power, that was not only basically undamaged, but was doing fantastic. When the United States entered the Second World War coming out of a depression, by 1945, just a few years later, the economy is not just booming, it's bursting. We're dying to export, and the rest of the world is absolutely destitute. That's a wonderful combination for a multi-decade cycle to take place that is unlike anything that will ever happen again, we hope, right? I mean, if that's what it takes to have economic dominance, that's millions and millions and millions of lives, right? So hopefully not again. But if that's the period, that unusual period, this golden age where you set your expectations of what your, what a middle-class lifestyle is, maybe it's not representative. And I think maybe that's what that billionaire Green was trying to say. During that time period, trade unions were very strong in the United States in the private sector. We still have strong trade unions in the United States, but they're public sector unions. Firefighters, police, teachers, people like that, who are all very popular with the public, but public sector unions are different than private sector unions. The entire dynamic and relationship between management and worker is different when management is all of us. and when taxes are involved and a country doesn't have to make a profit versus a private business. So the dynamic is different. Public employees are thriving as a group in the United States right now, or at least treading water. Private unions are almost gone. The last number I saw of American workers that belonged to a private sector union was about 7%. That number was like 35%, almost 40% in the 50s. Now, what do trade unions do? Well, they often increase the cost of stuff, which might sound bad to you if you want to hire a plumber, and the plumber's a member of the union, and because they are, they're making double what they might make otherwise, but it's darn good for the plumber. There's a lot of people out there who argue that, you know, things like outsourcing and sending jobs to countries where poor people are exploited and they make a $2 a day or whatever, that's good for Americans because the stuff at your local outlet store is a lot cheaper. But, you know, in a funny way, if you have to then make up for the people at that store not making enough money, so they're on all kinds of government aid, I mean, that's like a backdoor tax increase, isn't it? Which is exactly what higher-priced goods would be, too. But if it supports jobs, that's a net benefit, I would say. And I think the fact that, you know, at times where trade unions were a good functioning part of U.S. society, I think some of that was supported. Minimum wage laws are another way to take the free market and give it a bottom, if you will, right? A way to protect incomes at the minimum level. And during most of this so-called golden age in American expectation setting when it comes to economics, the top tax rate was 90%. Estate taxes were taxed at 70%. Bam. That's huge. That's big. I don't agree with that myself. But it does show you that the country was in a very different economic climate. And what's amazing is things were still so good that you could have those kinds of things that most wise businessmen, Mitt Romney would say that's a huge productivity drag. Yeah, well, that shows you how much the times were good for Americans. You could have that kind of productivity drag and things were still great economically until you really hit the early 1970s. The 1970s are kind of the acknowledged point where, you know, the giant Second World War economic, unrealistic maybe, economic boom for Americans kind of began to wind down. And the way Americans, you know, and we're generalizing here, all these kinds of, when you talk about economics, it's all generalization. But the way Americans seem to try to deal with that, most of them anyway, is not to do what the billionaire we mentioned earlier, Mr. Green, said they should do, which is change their expectations. But if they could afford to figure out a way to continue to keep up that lifestyle. One of the things that began to happen more and more that sort of masked, in terms of the statistics, what was going on was another person in the household would often go to work. So instead of having the traditional 1950s, you know, suburban, you know, father goes out to work, mother stays home and take care of the kids, Norman Rockwell kind of America, you now had the mother oftentimes going out and working as well, which allowed those families to somehow maintain with two people something close to the income they used to expect with one. Kind of masked the fact, though, that the job market was changing and what a person could expect to take home from a job was changing. The other thing that happened is they began to borrow. And not just credit, but as the 1980s began to wind down, also to get a little money generally from the older generation before them. A lot of people were inheriting money or able to use and draw on family funds. And the combination of beginning to eat up that money and beginning to borrow more and more eventually leads to, you know, in a very broad sense, where we were at this last, you know, subprime mortgage crisis, where, you know, the last refuge for most people in terms of value of something they owned that they could borrow against was their home. And if that was overvalued and you borrowed more than you owned at a certain point, well, then you're underwater, and that just happened to a ton of Americans. And so basically, if you want to look at the long view, maybe you could make a case that what you just saw in the last 5 or 6 years was the bottoming out of trends, you know, that had started winding down since the early 1970s, right? People ran out of money that they could beg, borrow, steal. And now they're confronted with, as a class, with something that Americans had broadly avoided, as the billionaire Jeff Green had said, coming to grips with the fact that maybe what they bring home in their paychecks can't pay for a lifestyle that they see as middle class. Again, that's a relative term. It's a perception. Now, as you might imagine, this creates fear, insecurity, anger, and all sorts of emotions that the political class can use. I mean, and that's, again, why we get back to the point of why is this even coming up now? Because people want something to help make the situation better. This opens up a whole bunch of questions. Now, if I start with what Jeff Green said, and he says that the Americans' expectations are out of line, I would love to know what can be done to recalibrate economic expectations. I mean, if Americans think that owning an iPhone, as just one example, or a couple of TVs in the house is what a middle-class lifestyle is, how do you convince them that, no, not anymore? Middle-class people on middle-class incomes, people who make what you make, shouldn't expect to have that. How do you do that? Is there any way society can artificially change people's expectations? I mean, what, do you start a marketing campaign from government? You can't afford your lifestyle, just letting you know. I mean, public service announcement. This question came up the other day at an Iowa get together with Republican hopefuls for president. And the approach and the answers and everything that came out of that I thought was very indicative, because to me, again, my opinion, it looked like the people that are serious about getting a shot at the White House were the ones that understood that the president and the Democrats had moved the battlefield, at least for now, you know, into this income inequality terrain. And we're willing to take that on. The ones that, you know, there are people who run for president because it's almost a good career move. I mean, Sarah Palin's making noise about doing it. And people, I had someone say to me, is she crazy? Is she just so out of touch? And I said, no, that's a good career move. That keeps her out front. She doesn't have to win. She just gets her out in these debates. I mean, it's good for her career. There are lots of people like that. They're the ones, though, who will play to the crowd in some of these situations with opinions that if they actually had to take them to the electorate as a whole, hole would get them just crushed. I have a story here. Where was this one? This one was from the American edition of the British newspaper, The Guardian. The author is John Swain, and the headline is, Republicans united against Obama but cannot agree on income inequality. And here's how the piece starts. It says, quote, conservative Republicans spurned pleas from some potential presidential contenders this weekend for a new appeal to America's working class, highlighting an internal disagreement over income inequality that has become an early dividing line in the party's 2016 primary, end quote. Again, folks, that's not by accident, right? That's because the president, you know, lined up where the battlefield's going to be, and the Republicans are now forced to respond to it. And as I said, it's not a traditional Republican strength, this kind of battlefield. You can tell by the reaction of this crowd to what these presidential hopefuls said. And let's point out that this crowd is not only not representative of American voters nationwide, it's also not representative of Republicans nationwide. It's also not representative even of Republicans in Iowa. It's a specific group chosen for their specific, the article says, Tea Party-like views. That's another term I hate. But it gives you an idea of where the story is going. Now, listen to the reaction that John Swain says the crowd had to these politicians' comments, and listen to which politicians, you know, say the unpopular things that the crowd doesn't like anyway, and which ones sort of pander to the crowd. So Swain's piece continues from the middle, quote, "Yet calls from Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey and Rick Santorum, a former U.S. Senator for Pennsylvania, for the party to devote itself to poorer Americans who've been left behind by the country's steady economic recovery, often met with silence in a theater in Des Moines. We need to be the party of the worker," said Santorum to no applause. He went on to criticize an emphasis on entrepreneurs that became the theme of 2012's Republican National Convention, where Obama, I guess he means President Obama, was repeatedly attacked for his perceived claim that bosses, quote, didn't build, end quote, their companies. Santorum says, quote, "What percentage of Americans own their own business?" Santorum asked, before answering, "Less than 10. Republicans continue to focus their election campaigns on this minority," said the former senator, "and then we wonder why we don't win," end quote. So Christie and Santorum are basically taking the president's challenge and saying, okay, I guess for now, this is where the battlefield's going to be fought. I'm trying to appeal eventually to the large group of Americans who are concerned about this, but I have to face a group of hardliners who don't think this issue is important at all. Mike Huckabee, former Arkansas governor, plays to that group and says, quote, "Sometimes I think the greatest challenge we face economically is intelligence inequality. We will never be able to build a strong economy when we punish productivity." The crowd erupted into cheers, author John Swain says. Swain says that speakers like Governor Scott Walker and Dr. Ben Carson came forward and talked about the U.S. being a meritocracy where anyone with talent and work ethic could survive. The audience liked that. Those are traditional Republican talking points, and at certain times they are very popular and they resonate very clearly with a lot of Americans. It depends on the circumstances, right? But people like Chris Christie and Rick Santorum, who are looking ahead to where a general election battlefield might be should they win their party's nomination, which is tough when you have to get by this kind of crowd, said this, quote, "There is an economic stagnation in this country, but there's also an overwhelming feeling that for your family, it's just not possible to get ahead," said Christie, who was already viewed by some in attendance, Swain writes, as a moderate worthy of suspicion. Lamenting a multiple-year stagnation in the median income of American workers, Christie urged Republicans to assemble a coalition, quote, "that is comprised at its core of a proud but underserved and underrepresented working class in this country," end quote, Swain says, again prompting silence from the rows of voters. Christie called for, quote, "every domestic policy we advance, every decision we make, to be targeted at improving the lives of middle class and poorer households," explaining, Swain says, that, quote, "the rich are doing fine," end quote. Again, the crowd of Republican Iowans in this small group of 1,200 at this conference didn't like that. And Christie went on and said, quote, "we don't demonize the wealthy, as many folks in the Democratic Party do, but nor should we cater to the wealthy at the expense of our middle-income workers and working poor, who are the backbone of every American community," end quote. Swain then writes, after a beat, a few hesitant claps broke out on the theater's lower level. Others slowly joined in, end quote. Now, to me, those are politicians who look ahead and go, God, it's going to be tough to get through the nominating process with Republican hardliners, you know, with these kinds of attitudes. But you guarantee in this climate, we're not going to win the national election unless we can somehow punch back against Democrats who are fighting us on rocky, broken Indian ground, right? Native American battlefields, to tie up all of our little metaphors and whatnot. There was an article in the online edition of the Seattle Times the other day by columnist Danny Westneat in the January 23rd, 2015 edition of the paper, where he brought up the names of some other Republican hopefuls, including some who are considered to be very conservative indeed, bringing up the income inequality question, too. He had a funny way of doing it. There's a apparently a socialist on the Seattle City Council. And so he quotes these Republican statements without telling you that they're from these Republicans. And it sounds like the socialist city council member of Seattle talking, but instead it's these famous Republicans. For example, he has this quote, quote, "The facts are, we're facing right now a divided America when it comes to the economy. The top 1% earned a higher share of the national income than any year since 1928, end quote. And then goes on to, you know, reveal that that was, he says, Tea Party Texas Senator Ted Cruz who said that. Then he has another quote, quote, "Under Obama, the rich have gotten richer. Income inequality has gotten worse, and there are more people in poverty than ever before." And then pulls back the curtain and says that that was Mitt Romney who said that, you know, Bain Capital's executive. Then he has another quote, quote, "While the last 8 years have been pretty good ones for top earners, they've been a lost decade for the rest of America," end quote. And that's Jeb Bush's quote. And then he says later on in the piece, quote, "That the GOP is now tilting at the 1% is one of the more remarkable messaging flip-flops of all time. Not long ago, someone saying what Ted Cruz is now saying would have been accused by Ted Cruz of engaging in class warfare. He said most of this change is just political necessity," end quote. And what he says is with Obama's, President Obama's job numbers going up, that this becomes the only terrain economically that they can hit him at, and that's that the majority of Americans who are getting more jobs are still not seeing, you know, enough of an income increase to get them from the position that they were upset with being in to one where they're less upset. And then he does what I do, which is to point out that this is the beginning of laying the groundwork for the battlefield that the 2016 campaign will be fought on. He says, quote, "But the direction of the messaging shift is also significant. It's the first big political tell of the 2016 election. Though they just won a resounding election victory in November," he writes, "Republicans, surprisingly, are retreating to adopt the other side's frame on what ails the country, namely, that the economy isn't working for anyone but the rich," end quote. Then he goes on to point out that Americans are supporting one of these things that billionaire Jeff Green would consider to be one of the radical sorts of reactions that might happen in the future. They're supporting increases in minimum wage, you know, for workers in this country. And he points out that even the red states are doing it, and the numbers are overwhelming of Americans that are supporting big minimum wage increases. And again, if you're a billionaire like Jeff Green, you might think that that's an example of the downsides of what's going to happen if Americans don't get happier one way or the other with their economic situation. Green had said they need to alter their expectations. Another suggestion would be to try to figure out, you know, how to get a better job. But that brings us to the foundational questions I've sort of been teasing this whole time, which are, what if the system that we take for granted here in this country as though it's an economic law of nature, an ideology, a post-Second World War, especially post-1980 maybe, ideological belief that the free market will solve everything and that there really isn't any alternative to it? I mean, like I said, a law of physics. The foundational question we need to ask here that both parties are avoiding is, what if it doesn't? I mean, what if the free market, which is supposed to determine wages, determines that the wages are lower than what Americans will stand for? I mean, one of the downsides of thinking that the free market will solve everything is not having any debates over questions like, what if it doesn't? Is that sort of like a religion in that sense, Ben? I mean, is it like, you know, having a religious debate and then saying, well, what if there's no God? And the person on the other side of the debate goes, well, wait a minute, there's a God. We have to agree on that or we can't have a discussion. What if the majority of the electorate begins to disagree with the statement that the free market, you know, should be the one guiding things like wages and jobs and the economy? And, you know, it reminds me that, you know, during most of the 20th century, there were other economic systems out there that presented broad alternatives to the, let's call it the assumptions of the West, the assumptions of the United States and Great Britain especially, right? For most of the 20th century, you had communism. And you still have communist countries, but it's not like the old days. I mean, North Korea, or even if you want to call China still officially communist, it's not like it was when communism was portraying itself as the future. You know, the idea that the workers and the class system and all that are hangovers from other eras and colonial eras and all that kind of stuff, and that that's old thinking and a thing of the past, and that the communists were the alternative to Western free market exploitative capitalist ideology, trying to remember all of my old Bolshevik buzzwords that used to be thrown around by the Bolsheviks, I should add. This was a giant societal alternative to buying into Western capitalism. And you did that because Western capitalism was inherently designed to maximize profits for a very small group of people who then exploited the masses. That's the communist ideology, right, in a nutshell. And some of the stories that I actually cut out here, you know, were asking whether or not income inequality, broad and extreme income inequality, was a natural facet of capitalism, one that had maybe been to a degree hidden by the golden age from 1945 to 1972, 73, 74, right? Maybe we're starting to see capitalism revert to what it reverts to, you know, in the gilded age, maybe, some people might say. Now, while everybody who knows their history knows that the communists for the 20th century were always portrayed as the alternative to Western capitalism and everything, less people realize that the Nazis had this sort of an element in their ideology, too. The reason why is because trying to get your mind around Nazi ideology will drive you crazy, because there's so many facets that are just sort of thrown into the Nazi ideological stew. And you know, whereas the communists would have, you know, council and meeting and internationals and debates over the meaning of this or that little teeny word as it related to communism, so they could try to develop some sort of classroom consistent philosophy. The Nazis didn't care. We got this racism we have here. We have this view of going back to a pre-Christian new man. And we have, you know, throw in anything you want. But one of the ideologies that was an ingredient in the stew, and Hitler even talks about it in Mein Kampf, is this idea once again about the decadence of Western capitalism, right? Of what the British and the Americans sort of preach, this idea that fosters a dangerous and unhealthy and unseemly materialism on the part of all their people, a greedy, materialistic, money-oriented society that subverts more noble human values. Weird to hear the Nazis talk about that, obviously, but this was the idea that there are ideas like honor and all these kinds of things. You actually hear it in First World War Germany, too, a sort of a sneering at Western capitalism as debasing the higher qualities of human existence. Now, both those societies have obviously gone the way of the dodo, leaving us in an almost triumphalist mood here in the United States and Great Britain and the West and the EU and everything else, where free market capitalism is not just considered to be the alternative to those other systems, but the only one that works, right? Like a law of physics. You talk to people about this and you say, well, what if this free market system of ours doesn't create enough good jobs for enough people to be satisfied, you know, with it, and you get met by like a deer in the headlights stare sometimes. Even having this discussion is foreign to people sometimes. But those are the kind of questions I feel, you know, without having answers, by the way, would be very, very important for us to have right now. And the kind that I think are little tweaks of the system put off. We don't have to have the discussion about whether or not the free market system that we all buy into, I buy into it myself, whether or not that's going to actually get the job done. We don't have to have that, because we'll just say, I'll give you a $2,500 tax credit to send your kids to college. And by the way, I'll give you the Affordable Care Act. I'll give you Obamacare so that, you know, you're suffering less and so your lives are better, so we don't have to have this free market discussion, right? And I had mentioned earlier that I was going to give President Obama credit for helping the poor. Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, helps the poor, folks. You may not like it. It wasn't my choice. I think we had to have something. I didn't want something that the insurance companies were guaranteed an income, you know, for having. But we would be remiss if we didn't notice that this makes people's lives better. It may cost us a fortune. It may be economically unsustainable. Who knows? But there's a lot of people right now whose lives are better because of it. Give credit where it's due. But again, I think we're treating symptoms. You open up community college and make it free, like the president was saying in his State of the Union speech. Is that going to help individuals? Yeah, it's going to help individuals, but it's not going to deal with the underlying problem. And if the jobs that those people who go to community college and improve their skills so they can get a better job, if those jobs pay them $500 a month more or $1,000 a month more, is that better for them? Yes, it's better for them. Does that solve their problem? No. most of those people are not going to make enough money from that education for the grand issue to be solved. This is what, you know, when Bill Clinton was supporting the trade agreements, we talked endlessly about this in previous shows, but when he was trying to sell trade agreements to people, you know, in his base from the old Democrats from the 1980s who had opposed all those agreements because they were bad for American workers, when Clinton and the new Democrats were trying to sell those, they offered things like education as ways around the problem. Don't worry. With education, we will be able to overcome this and people will get better jobs, right? They'll all be working in software and, you know, those terrible, dirty industrial jobs that broke your back and, you know, from the coal mining generation, those will all be in other countries will do that and they'll be glad to have them. It's a win-win-win. And here we are decades later and it's not a win-win-win. Americans aren't making enough. They're going to start to question the system if we can't figure out a way that this logically comes to a place down the road where Americans are either getting what they think they deserve or where they start to think they deserve, you know, something more in line with what they're actually making, which is what Jeff Green, the billionaire, wants. Again, I don't know how you do that. I think what people will do instead is vote for anything that promises to fix the problem. For those who would say, Dan, there is no alternative to what we do now. Questioning it does no good because it's the only system that works. You know, you're barking up a wrong tree. I'm going to suggest to you that none of what you say prevents people from doing it anyway. At your expense, at my expense, at the country's expense. Look at Greece right now. Now, I won't lie to you. Now, if you don't know what happened in Greece, by the way, they just voted in, I don't want to say this the wrong way, but long story short, they voted in one of the more leftist governments that the EU or any of the major first world countries have had for a long time. It was shocking to a lot of people. And the reason that the Greeks did this in part was because they've just had it with people telling them what the economic laws are and that they just have to live with it. Eventually, people just say, I don't care that you keep telling me, economically speaking, that the sky is blue. I don't like the blue sky. Someone's promising me a red sky. I'm voting for them. This is what people like Jeff Green, the billionaire, are worried about. And by the way, I have an article that says that the number two issue to millionaires who were surveyed, number two, 77% of millionaires said their number two issue was income inequality from an NBC News article. So, it's not just poor and middle-class people who are worried about this and rich people who are going off to their private yachts like the Monopoly Man with monocles and cigars and, you know, tons of beautiful women. They're worried about this, too, and they're worried about it because they realize that the only way that this system continues, that they're operating, that's working well for them, right? That's working well for a bunch of us. The only way it continues is if you can manage to make the people who are not doing well in this system more satisfied. You know, we mentioned earlier this concept of the future of work. If you go Google that, you're going to run into a bunch of articles, some by economists, some by other experts, some by just thinkers, who are talking about not the far future, the near future, and the fact that what that billionaire Jeff Green was saying about the future, seeing millions of more jobs go away, that people are theorizing about societies that have no jobs in the sort of the unskilled great mass of jobs that, you know, we used to have factory workers doing, that all that stuff will go away, that robots will do it all, software will do it all, cars are going to be driven by Google or something. I mean, but you'll find a bunch of articles that are theorizing. I mean, I'm looking at one right now from the Washington Post entitled, "We're Heading to a Jobless Future No Matter What the Government Does." And again, there are always going to be people working. There are always going to be people excelling and exceeding expectations and all those kinds of things. But there's got to be a percentage of the general public that's got to be enjoying at least a minimal amount of prosperity. I don't know what that number is, to keep your society stable. I would love to have some sort of a national conversation on both what that level is and how we, you know, go about creating a situation where those people have a better chance of reaching that level. And again, if it sounds like you're interfering with the natural laws of the marketplace will determine what these people should make, Dan. Yes, but whether or not those people are satisfied with what they make will be determined by them, and they vote. All right? So part of making the system work is having enough people doing well enough in it so that they don't lose confidence in it. You know, what do you do to maintain people's faith in the way things are? Maybe that's a good way to put it. I would love to bring the people on all sides of this issue together to some sort of public forum. I have dreams about this, by the way. When I dream about reform, I have these, let's call them utopian dreams of some giant talk show where 45 million Americans tune in once a week for an hour and a half discussion with a questioner like Vincent Brown in Ireland, just one of these dogged, never let up, never accept pablum for an answer, you know, bore in, and you get the politicians and you get the intellectuals and you get a live public, and you have this forum that fills the spot of what, you know, a Greek center of government where the public could come and debate issues, or a Roman one in the Roman Republic. It fulfills that sort of, you know, place. And it would be, in my mind, the natural evolution of what they often had in sort of the late 60s, those now much lampooned, you know, talk shows where intellectuals would get together and they'd have cigarettes and it'd be black and white and they'd discuss these deep issues of the day and they'd have a live audience a lot of times. And they were very intellectual. And you thought, well, if that evolves over the decades, what an interesting place that kind of genre could fill in our society by, oh, 2015. But truthfully, and especially because of the fragmentation of media, of which I'm a beneficiary, we don't have any central, you know, place like that. People fragment and go to their own political areas, whether it's Fox News or MSNBC or what have you, and hear their own experts reinforce their own viewpoints and speak to their own subset of people, as opposed to us all getting together and are forced to hash deep questions like this out in the public realm. And I've always been of the opinion that a lot of the positions people take and a lot of the solutions they suggest would not stand the light of day, would not hold up to two good, powerful follow-up questions, you know, after the standard talking point is given in response. And that exposing the vacuousness of a lot of this thinking and forcing deeper thinking and bringing the public along with you and allowing them to ask questions and explain, you know, I'm a plumber from Arkansas and let me tell you what I'm trying to live off of. And, you know, is this about how much I should be making or should this really be happening to me? And force people into situations where there's a national discussion on this. Is it utopian to think we could have a national discussion? That's interesting to consider. Is it unrealistic to think about a forum like that even happening? I don't know. I hope not, because to me, that doesn't involve any government. I think if you sold it right, the ratings could be huge. But maybe I'm wrong. And certainly I'm wrong about getting 45 million Americans to watch any one thing that isn't connected to the Super Bowl or the college football playoffs. Sorry, thinking about a very long halftime show in black and white with cigarettes. And, you know, I've got it. Some of the questions written down here, and I think any one of these might make a whole common sense show by itself and might have made a more interesting one to get into today, actually. But I'd like to throw some of these things out to you as just possible questions that wouldn't it be interesting to hear the movers and the shakers and the thinkers and the experts in our society mixed with, as I said, a fantastic questioner, discuss some of these deep questions in front of all of us. I mean, I would say something like, as a question, I would say, if the free market is supposed to determine wages, what happens if the wages are too low? I have another question written down here that says, given automation, global labor pools, etc., what is the future of middle and lower income work in the developed world? Can societies exist without work and jobs that will pay the bills? And what is the alternative to jobs for most people? I'd like to discuss questions about, you know, where this problem lies. I mean, is this a question of opportunity? In which case we could debate whether or not opportunity is changing because of current global trends. Or is this a problem, you know, inherent in cultures or individuals, right? I mean, there are parts of the United States that have remained poor throughout the decades, no matter what you do. By the way, before anyone, you know, talks about racial or ethnic questions, there are white communities in places that just, I mean, you can go to like the hills of West Virginia and they've been poor there forever. Is that a cultural thing or is it an individual thing? And if it's a cultural thing, what can you do to change it? Is ambition something that you're born with or something that can be encouraged? What about a work ethic? Is a work ethic affected by making life too comfortable for someone? I mean, I, as I said, I know people who suggest that the reason that people worked so hard, you know, after the Depression is because they lived through the Depression. I'd love to ask the politicians if they couldn't use the tax code to address some of these problems, what they would do instead. If you didn't have that ability to just say, we'll give you this much money and I've helped you out, right? What else would you do? And listen, maybe healthcare is a wonderful example of that. To go back to that article by Phil Graham, the senator, he's basically saying that when you throw in things like healthcare, that's like giving money to the poor. And that's fine, but giving money and having a job that pays the bills are two real separate things. You kind of have to give the money because they don't have the good-paying job. If they have the good-paying job, you get all these subsidiary benefits besides the fact you don't have to give them as much money. Subsidiary benefit number one is they're a contributing member of society with a sense of self-worth, and it builds an example for others around them. It's just better to have people working. If you had to have a society like some of the ones I was reading about, these jobless futures, where they're basically suggesting that people will just have to be given money to spend, you turn around and you think to yourself, are those going to be happier people because they don't have to go to work? Or is there something about being a human being? Well, maybe most of us, let's not speak for everybody, where getting up and having a purpose is important to you, your health or what have you, mental or physical. Again, a good question to maybe talk about in that talk show. Finally, I would love for this really deep, intense questioner, relentless questioner, to ask about some of the proposed solutions that are thrown out there so often. Because I think things like saying, we'll send you to community college, while not bad, masks the fact that sending you to community college won't really get you out of the problem that you're in here. I mean, if you ask a question like, how much of an effect do common proposed solutions really have on this problem? Could we educate ourselves out of it? Or is that the standard excuse used by politicians to avoid having to admit how bad the issue is? And if more education helps only minimally, and we admitted that, then what do you do? Well, that's the purpose of these questions. If you say, listen, if your solution to this problem doesn't work, what's next? And maybe the what's next is a better idea than what you're being forced to put up with as a excuse or an answer. You know, to begin with, you may say, skip the, you know, free community college. I love that answer you gave about what we'll do if the community college idea doesn't work years down the line. Finally, I'd like to bring up something that Thomas Piketty, the economist, made a very big deal of in his book that we haven't talked about here. And it's important, but I feel like, again, a different show maybe, or we've talked about it a lot in the past also. Piketty brings up the dangers to a free society of having an extreme disparity in wealth between the lowest and the highest. I told you earlier that I don't mind people having money at all, unless they use that money to affect the political equality of Americans. You know, the problem I have in this society with money is that it's influential in a way that games the political system towards a smaller number of people when we're supposed to have an equal amount of ability to impact, you know, the direction that the government goes, right? The one man, one vote principle. And, you know, it's worth asking again at our big TV, 45 million people watching forum, and just say, you know, is it even possible for wealthy people to not be influential? I mean, if Dan Carlin's problem is that they're influencing the political system in ways that give them political power out of proportion to their numbers, is it even possible to expect it would go otherwise? I mean, you know, people with a lot of money can be influential without even trying. The fact that you can give someone a job or anything like that has people reacting differently to you right away. So that's another fundamental question worth asking. People like liberal economist Paul Krugman will suggest that the inequality of political power is part of what created the inequality in economic power. He said in January 2015, quote, competition from emerging economy exports has surely been a factor depressing wages in wealthier countries, although probably not the dominant force. More important, soaring incomes at the top were achieved in large part by squeezing those below, by cutting wages, slashing benefits, crushing unions, and diverting a rising share of national resources to financial wheeling and dealing. Perhaps more important still, the wealthy exert a vastly disproportionate effect on policy, and elite priorities, obsessive concern for budget deficits with the supposed need to slash social programs, have done a lot to deepen wage stagnation and income inequality. End quote. In other words, his point is that the political power of the people, for example, who might have given money to years of Democratic and Republican presidents to pass trade deals, for example, that might not have been good for the average American worker, that's created the kind of system where we have this wealth inequality, and that the wealth inequality can create a political system where, you know, a small group of people have more power than the large group of people who are supposed to be the majority, who dictates the direction that policy goes. It has long been believed that economic inequality will inevitably undermine political equality. And if that happens, then you have to ask yourself whether or not the average voters of this country should even vote to continue doing things the way they are. After all, the way they are isn't the way they're supposed to be. Again, another wonderful topic for our black and white cigarettes live audience and intelligentsia program airing halftime at the Super Bowl. I've been telling you about Audible on this program for years now, literally. I've watched their catalog move from tens of thousands of offerings once upon a time to more than 150,000 titles at the moment, and of course ever growing. Every genre you can think of, Audible continually surprises me with some of the new stuff they had. I was on there the other day looking for something to recommend to you today, and there was something very interesting. It's not my official recommendation, but there was a piece on the House Un-American Activities Committee hearings over like 30 years. It was like 41 hours of testimony that had sort of been culled, because I guess there's a lot of boring testimony that no one would want to hear, but they find like the good chunks that are interesting, historically speaking, and string them together. I thought, well, that's very interesting. That's an example of something I wouldn't have expected to find on Audible, and was pleasantly surprised to find it, and something that actually works better in the audio form than the text form, regardless of, you know, your personal preference. I mean, certain things just work better in one form or the other. And that's a wonderful example of something that you'd rather hear in the audio form with original audio thrown in and stuff like that. Nonetheless, the book I'd like to recommend to you today, and if you sign up for Audible at audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin, you can get your free audiobook, is one by one of my favorite historians to reference when talking about the First World War. And if you've heard any of our Blueprint for Armageddon series, you've probably heard me quote something from Peter Hart. Not only is he wonderful with his particular style, and of course, maybe I'm biased because it's a lot of what we do in the history show too, where you mix, you know, your history with firsthand accounts of people who were there or who have some sort of, you know, from the time period impression to yield. He does a wonderful job, and his choice of, you know, primary sources is fantastic, and he's just revisionist enough to make you question some of your long-held beliefs. And his ability to explain situations from multiple angles, you know, the high command level all the way down to the poor guy on the ground level is fantastic. He's got a book called Fire and Movement, The British Expeditionary Force in the Campaign of 1914, which is about perhaps the most interesting time in the First World War, the initial encounters, when both sides were just shocked to find out that those, you know, pseudo-Napoleonic tactics that they were still using with sometimes their bright uniforms and what have you were absolutely suicidal. There was a point in time where those lessons were learned, and they're the initial encounters, and that's what Fire and Movement, the British Expeditionary Force, the campaigns of 1914 deals with. A chance to look at the unbelievable casualties that the French and the Germans suffered, the early trench warfare periods. Hart's got several great books on the First World War, but this one is for all those people that thought things like the Battle of the Frontiers and the Battle of the Marne were so interesting. And who better to give it to you than Peter Hart, who's going to give it to you from the, as I said, high command level all the way down to the grunt level, and at the same time challenge with a little potent and yet logically argued revision, you know, some of your long-held belief in the situation. Check it out. He's wonderful, and I've liked everything I've ever read from him. And you could go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin and get your free audiobook download.
Thanks to everyone for posting comments about the show on iTunes. They help get the program noticed.
Want to help the podcast? Just buy your Amazon.com products through the Amazon search window on DanCarlin.com, and Dan and the gang will get a percentage of what you spend, and it helps these guys out because they are nice young fellas.
If you think the show you just heard is worth a dollar, Dan and Ben would love to have it. It's about the cost of a soft drink and yet so much more stimulating. A buck a show. It's all we ask.